Sarah, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me about your book, Heartland.
I'm so happy to be talking with you. Thank you.
So I know that you researched and wrote this book over the course of 15 years, which is just, wow, that's took a lot of determination. What kept you motivated?
You know, it felt like such an imperative at a deep, deep level that I'm not sure I sensed that I even had a choice. Of course I did, but it was maybe less of a challenge-seeking motivation than it was just a challenge for delivering on something I knew I had to do at all costs. So even when I was a little kid, I would tell my grandmother specifically, who is a large character in the book, that I was going to write a book about our family someday, she reports to me. And yeah, I think I just, for me, the motivation, it was never lacking, or the inspiration or wherewithal. It was just more like tangible resources like finances and even time.
And like, we learn a lot about your family in this book. Mm-hmm. How did it feel to shift from journalistic writing to writing something that is very vulnerable?
You know, that's such a good question. Early in my career as a writer, I had a sort of bifurcated writer self. So there was the journalist in me that was in some ways kind of a mercenary and went out and applied my writing skills for a paycheck, but also because I believe in the media and I wanted to be a sort of government watchdog. And then there was this much more private and personal writer self that was writing memoir passages and tucking those away in a drawer, returning to them when I had the time. And so, you know, it was the evolution of those pieces of my writer self were actually kind of simultaneous. So what you or readers might sense as, you know, a journalist now turning to more personal writing, what that's really just reveals that one piece of the writer puzzle was out in public and the other wasn't yet. But, you know, as far as the contrast of those experiences, I had a little bit of practice for this sort of book launch in that for about the last 5 years, I started shifting toward a more first-person driven and personalized journalism. So I come out of a very traditional journalism school. Well, at least when I was there, I started journalism school in 1998 and finished in 2002. I was a member of the last class of my J school that had just kind of an old-fashioned hard-ass newspaper training. So this is just right before all of the multimedia convergence came in and transformed university curricula. So I was absolutely taught, do not use the first person. You keep your own ass out of there. You're there to at least aspire to objectivity, whether that is ultimately possible or not. Probably isn't, but it is nonetheless an admirable objective to strive toward, I think, in particular brands of journalism. So the real conflict for me in what you're describing this was allowing myself to come in to writing that was ultimately about public issues and policy and even politics on some level, and let my own family story and voice be integrated into the more fact-based writing.
Yeah, and I think that this book is like, it's a wonderful convergence of work that you've done in terms of covering places like your home state of Kansas and the middle of the country, but then also your personal story as well and your family story. I'm wondering, this is a question I have, because of how your home community is sort of covered, or how you see it covered in journalism, what do you think is the biggest misconception that others have about Kansas and where you grew up?
I think that probably, now if you would have asked me this question 10 years ago, I might have had a different answer. But right now, I think the most common misconception would be that the entire state is white and conservative. Let's say Trump's base, you know, living on the ground in a place like Kansas or anywhere that's cast as Trump country, one knows firsthand that these are actually diverse places in race, culture, politics, and every other way, just like blue states are. And so that has definitely informed my essays in the last few years.
You write that being white working class means containing both racial privilege and economic disadvantage. For example, you write about how your ancestors migrated west as a result of what you call profit-motivated propaganda. That was mm-hmm. less about developing farmers and more about commodifying the land and exploiting immigrant labor. Mm-hmm. Yet you also argue that your pioneer ancestors were complicit in the government-sanctioned genocide of indigenous peoples. How do you make sense of your heritage in light of this complicated history?
Oh, gosh. It is a complicated one, isn't it? And they all are, of course. For me, you know, I can give you kind of an anecdote that gives a little window into the experience you just shared with your readers and maybe listeners. When I was a kid, I was 4 years old in 1984. My dad, who was a fourth generation wheat farmer and a carpenter, bought a little piece of land, truly just a couple miles from the exact same piece of dirt that he himself grew up on. And he was going to build a new house for my pregnant mother and four-year-old me and himself, and this would be where he'd raise his family. In digging the foundation, he found arrowheads, which is just a common feature of the Midwestern landscape, and our part of Kansas was only about, 50 miles or so north of the Oklahoma line, which when my ancestors were coming to Kansas, that was the line between the Kansas Territory and quote-unquote Indian Territory, which was, of course, where indigenous tribes were basically forced to move by the young federal United States government. And, you know, I remember my dad telling me somewhere along the way of growing up that, you know, he's a white working class dude, so kind of the vision or the image of some stereotype that people hold about, I don't know, conservative politics or racism. And actually, that's not my dad at all. He told me, you know, how stunned he was and moved at that moment, finding those arrowheads. And, you know, like he, and like myself, was a descendant of people who were themselves immigrants and impoverished. And they answered a call to essentially move west and take supposedly free land in the Homestead Act from the federal government that benefited them while tribes that had been there for centuries were driven out. And so, you know, I think in that story, I always, in any story, place the greatest culpability on whoever has the greatest power in the situation. And in that situation, it would be the government and corporate and railroad and every other factions, not the poor European immigrants. However, you know, as my book points out, it is a complicated history because they were also white and benefited from that. So my dad said to me, you know, like he found these arrowheads and it struck him like, wow, this government and people we come from did some bad things. You don't have to have a college education to know that. I remember him saying that. So how do I make sense of it? You know, I just try to express the truth of the stories that I have witnessed firsthand, some of which go against what we're told in textbooks or national discourse or cable news. My goal is never so much to make sense of anything, I think, as it is to just reveal it and let it be whatever it is.
You also, in your book, you engage Wendell Berry. There's a part where you reference his work and how he writes about sustainability requiring the paying off of ecological and human debts. Yet you say that you don't know what's owed to certain versions of the countryside. And I'm curious, what do you mean by that? And if you think there are certain issues that arise when people start to talk about sort of returning to nature, returning to the land, or returning to the country.
You know, what I was getting at with that particular line, you know, so Wendell Berry, who I admire very much, a Kentucky farmer and activist and just a real poetic writer and longtime sage about just what America means and its land, he, in the passage that I was citing, is talking about this seeming line between rural life and city life and how our country is increasingly urbanized. And so he's talking about how a healthy city, which we're definitely in a metropolis privileging society and culture in many ways today. And so what he's talking about is how in order for a city to be a social unit of integrity, it must be in balance with the countryside around it. For him, when he's talking about some sort of debts owed in order for a balance to be reached, I think he might have been talking about, say, like the way that an urban population taxes the natural resources of a space. So, for example, some of the farmland that I would have inherited was seized via eminent domain by the state of Kansas to dig an enormous reservoir to essentially pipe drinking water to the people of Wichita. And then we had a private well for our water, like right next to this man-made lake that we ourselves couldn't access. So, you know, Wendell Berry is a bit of an environmentalist. So I think that that's what he was addressing. But when he was talking about the concept of deaths and how various injustices arise along the way of social progress, or so-called social progress, I was thinking about things like reparations for African Americans who are still suffering from the legacy of slavery that helped build a lot of white wealth in this country, or various policy level efforts to atone for our sins against indigenous peoples. And so in that passage, I'm really reflecting on whether somebody like a poor white person, someone who is descendant of European immigrants who answered a sort of, you know, siren from the United States of America, you can escape your blighted place on the other side of the Atlantic by coming here to this promised land. And what they found was hard sod and grasshoppers and a harder life perhaps even than they left. And so I guess I'm just reflecting, because those same people were white, and again, it's that complication of the racial privilege, is something owed to those people? You know, I think probably not in a formal policy-based sense as like an identity group, but I think that my book as a whole kind of argues that at the very least we can afford more respect to people in those rural areas who are doing things like growing the wheat and raising the cattle that people on the coast eat.
So in several instances, you also bring up your Roman Catholic background, and you describe growing up around a highly embodied expression of faith. So a people bonded, it seems, more deeply through labor, like renovating buildings, than through dogma. And the mm-hmm. physical body and the suffering of Jesus was central. And you also describe a Midwestern Catholic ethos of silence, which discouraged complaining, maybe on the part of workers against their resources. Can you say more about the role that religion plays in your experience and the white working class background and community that you come from?
So I can only speak for myself, and other people who are also under the umbrella of white working class will have very different experiences. But my very German Catholic, stoic, rural, Midwestern culture that I come out of was, like you say, very tactile in its spirituality. So there wasn't a lot of, as I get out in the book, this sort of, like, I don't know, uncomfortable merging of the political sphere and the religious sphere. Not that that hasn't always existed to some extent, but I think that in the last couple of decades, the religious right has really achieved breathtaking success in leveraging various social issues to ensure that people who might otherwise vote Democratic now vote Republican. That sort of proselytizing, you know, or just being in the context of a church and then receiving some message about how I was supposed to vote, that did not happen in my upbringing. And I don't know if it was because it just hadn't happened as a cultural shift yet, or because our rural remoteness made us a little bit late to some trends. But for me, Catholicism was every Sunday morning going a couple miles down the two-lane country blacktop highway to attend Mass in a small, clappered, 100-year-old church that my ancestors, who farmed that same land generations ago, had built themselves. My paternal grandfather rebuilt the steeple in the 1950s when my dad was a kid. My dad and his five siblings all went to school in the little schoolhouse next to it. It had closed by the time I was a kid. But that's where I had all of my sacraments. My parents were married. It was where we buried my grandparents on my father's side. It was where on Labor Day, this very small farming community gathered for an annual picnic. And, you know, like back in the 40s, in that same spot, my grandpa, who was a bit of a wild guy, would build kind of like a dance floor, sort of like a little deck right there on the prairie so that people could dance under the stars at this Labor Day gathering. And so it was like the church was a physical place and it was a gathering point. And yeah, we went inside and genuflected and stood up and sat down and repeated our memorized prayers in unison. But nobody ever in my upbringing was like going around talking about dogma outside of that space, or, you know, wagging a finger about religious right or wrong, or passing some sort of politicized judgment on any other group of people. And so in that way, it was a very quiet space. For me, it was experienced in a deeply personal way. I did leave the church in my mid-20s, but there were some really beautiful things about it. And as you mentioned, the physicality of Christ on the cross really, I think now when I look back as an adult, spoke to us, because he had blood running out of his hand on the cross, and my dad had blood running out of his hand from where he accidentally drove a nail into it when he was working on a construction site. So it made sense to us in a very literal way, I think, that might be lost on some other churchgoers.
Wow, that's a very powerful image there in terms of the way that the religious expression connects to what people are actually like living out. That's a very embodied faith. And I'm curious, based on what you said, because you've touched upon how modern movement of the religious right, and along with also what something else you described in the book as sort of this branding of conservative culture, that these are things that are not necessarily representative of, you know, all communities in the middle of the country, and didn't necessarily apply to your family, you know, or to your community in sort of the way that people might assume.
Right.
Do you feel that now that you go back, or I shouldn't say that you go back because you're still in Kansas,
yes.
and you're somebody who has kept your roots there, do you think that things have changed in the sense that part of that sort of that branding culture, or sort of these political fabrications to sort of unify people either around, you know, conservative ideology or certain social issues, do you think that has changed people that otherwise would have not, you know, judged people or cared about those issues in the same way?
I think probably yes, to some extent. So as far as my own family and just like the people closest to me that I grew up with in that area, or every like rural house and farm that was involved in my upbringing was sold by the time I graduated from college, which is reflects a national trend of what they call the death of the family farm. And so my folks, grandparents, sibling, and all that, they all live in Wichita now, which is the biggest city in Kansas. And, you know, they're country people by their roots, but they're now living in a pretty big town. And so I can't really use them and their views as a litmus. Their views, by the way, are very politically progressive, more so than they were when I was a kid in the 80s. So their shift has been to the left, and that is a brand of populism that is percolating in rural areas but gets less attention. As far as the seemingly more successful, at least initially, shift or movement in those places towards the right, I do kind of get a sense when I go into small town Kansas that there's more of a sense of identity around politics. And like the terms conservative and liberal, I mean, I was a bright kid, and I honest to goodness don't think I even knew what those words meant in the context of American politics when I was like a precocious teenager in a rural high school. And now I feel like, you know, and by the way, like, we didn't have cable TV in my farmhouse. We didn't have the internet. I didn't have a computer until I was a sophomore in college in, like, 1999 or 2000. So it could just be that, you know, a piece of this is that so many media outlets that would seek to propagandize in those places are now able to do so in a world in which the digital divide is not so pronounced, and even rural communities have the internet and cable television and all that. But I do get a sense, yeah, when I go into towns that feel familiar to me in one way, that there has been a shift toward, if not more conservative voting, because by the way, I'm not convinced that all that many people vote to begin with. I think that when we paint like whole states and counties red, it's really just a reflection of who goes to the polls, as opposed to the fabric of people and their beliefs on the ground. But I get a sense that people speak in a more politicized language, a more tribal language about politics than was remotely the case when I was a kid.
Yeah, and I think like this shift or to being more politicized in a certain way, or even what the terms conservative or liberal mean. I think the way that the sort of ground has shifted is really highlighted well in your book when you talk about your mom and how she voted for Carter. But you share that, you know, you were born a few months before Reagan's inauguration. And so in some ways, like what you say is that your life and the economic demise of American workers kind of unfolded in tandem. So in many ways, when reading your memoir, I felt like it was exposing a lot of failures of neoliberal policies that sort of soon followed. Do that really through concrete human stories. But my question for you is, what would be an alternative economic system or approach? What would that look like? Or as you put it towards the end of the book, what would an honest economic system look like for you?
You know, I would leave it to people who have studied such things to articulate the specifics of how to accomplish it. But I can say that, you know, what would be true in action in the sort of society that I envision or aspire to at the end of the book would be that every child would have, you know, something that reflected more of this American dream that we're telling ourselves that we're living here in this country than the current, essentially, plutocracy and capitalism gone wild world that we're sending underprivileged children into with the notion that if they work hard, they're going to reap their due reward. And so maybe that would look like free public college for everyone. So something like that at once solves the problem of kids who can't afford that sort of education if desired, and also removes the stigma of needing need if it's available to everyone to some extent. I think, too, that, you know, and then this is kind of another no-brainer to me, like, I don't know, some sort of regulation that reins in the CEO pay that, or underpayment at least of their workers that has resulted in this historic moment of wealth inequality. You know, I find that the neoliberal idea is so often about public programs, and whether they're in cahoots with Wall Street in the meantime is another conversation. But the, you know, the late 20th century, early 21st century liberalism is like, you know, welfare for poor folks, and it's done in a spirit of, it's almost more like a sense of charity among the privileged. Like, yes, please tax me because I'm very grand and I want the poor to be able to have this service. You know, I probably shouldn't have said that with such an edge, because it's not as though everyone with those views has condescension or classism baked into it, but when you are the person who is going to need to go apply for public programs and you're going to need to pee in a cup in order to do so, sometimes it feels less like support than it feels like somebody throwing some change at you. And then meanwhile, on the conservative end of the spectrum, this idea that a free market is some sort of just system is even more absurd and insulting. So where I think we should be focusing our energies and maybe even uniting across these divides, and you might even call them philosophical divides, is why don't we just pay working people more money? The majority of people who receive public assistance in this country are employed. They might be part-time employed by Walmart and then, like, not be able to pay their bills, receive public assistance by way of taxpayers, just to survive so that they can go on laboring for Walmart's profits. So I think that a lot of these conversations that paint this, you know, solving poverty as this great mystery, apparently they're just being had by people who deep down don't want to solve it, because I can tell you how to solve it. Give people money. End. The end. Give people money. Over. Fixed.